previously.tv podcast network.
Best of true crime television in 2017 in this year-end episode of The Blotter Presents. Give you a little bit more of the theme song than usual there. Best of the season for me to you in this special Hammock Week episode of The Blotter Presents. I'm your host, Sarah D. Bunting, and I'll be running down the best of the year in true crime TV. Got lists of the top 10 movies and series. So whether you're looking to kill just an afternoon with that aunt and uncle who want to know what the youngs are watching these days, or a whole week with your crime nut in-laws, chances are I've got the rec for you. Your recs also factored into the list, listeners, and I will be mentioning those as we go along. Let's get started. And let's start with the movies, because this is a TV true crime podcast. These are films that aired on television. I'll also note right here that while the podcast covered most of these properties over the last year, we didn't cover all of them. Check out our archives at previously.tv/podcasts. And if you're not seeing it there, when you click on The Blotter Presents, search the site at previously.tv with the property name. We probably did cover it. All right, here we go with the movies. My 10th best movie of the year in the true crime category was Casting JonBenet. We got hit with a barrage of JonBenet-related programming in 96, some of it interesting, much of it tawdry. Casting JonBenet was a rather late entrant to the anniversary proceedings, quote-unquote, and it was kind of a strange one. Director Kitty Green was eliciting memories and feelings from the Boulder community in the guise of casting a reenactment of sorts. And it can feel a little bit like it's exploiting the participants, but it's a very creative take on a case that, at least I thought, I knew pretty much everything there was to know about. And while casting JonBenet often made me uncomfortable, I was also riveted. That one's on Netflix, and it's our number 10. Number 9. Biggie, The Life of the Notorious B.I.G. is very pointedly more about the rapper's life, per the title, than the circumstances of his death, which, along with the death of Tupac Shakur, are about to be explored, I hesitate to say it, but ad nauseum, by a handful of projects in 2018. I am looking forward to them, but it is a lot. This one is well-built, informative, and a lot of fun. Like its subject, with top-notch talking heads and a heaping helping of the music that made Biggie a star. You can find that one on A&E's website. At number 8, we have Strong Island, filmmaker Yance Ford's intimate film about the murder of his brother and the unfairness of both the case's outcome. Law enforcement was evidently not in a hurry to catch the killer of a black man on Long Island, and the corrosive ripples traveling through Ford's family. Another entry that's more of a personal journey than a classic or stereotypical true crime story. But part of what I think as my job as a crime critic is to expand the definition to include properties that non-fans of the genre aren't able to scorn quite so easily. And if it did nothing else, and it did many things well, this movie turned me on to JVC Force, the artist behind the titular hip-hop break. If you like old school 80s rap, do yourself a favor and seek them out, and you can seek the movie out on Netflix. At number 7, we have Beware the Slender Man. Two tween girls try to kill a third friend to appease the Slender Man, a fictional monster born on the internet. Law enforcement and the families try to make sense of the aftermath, and for that matter, the heavenly creatures-esque beforemath. I enjoyed this film, but it does suffer from some amateurishness. Some of the Skype interviews, for instance, feel very high school AV club and not in the good American Vandal way. We'll get to that. And hindsight is 2020, but given that Anissa Wire, one of the perpetrators, has just this past week, as I record this, reached a settlement with prosecutors to enter treatment confinement, it does feel in retrospect like the filmmakers ought to have waited to see the sentencing through before committing to a final cut. But it's still a pretty good sit, and the story itself is so compelling that some of the filmmaking lapses can be overlooked. And if you overlooked this property, it is available on HBO Go. Number six is The Family I Had. Since I just spoke about this one last week with Kevin Flynn, I won't belabor the point, but I will issue once again the correction that while I readily agreed with Kevin's assertion that the filmmakers are Scandinavian, they really aren't. They are, however, European-styly in the best filmmaking ways. They're very patient in their information gathering. They're okay with the, quote, heroes of their film showing their asses at times, and they're not inclined to overexplain, even when more information seems all but required, i.e. the sugar dad thing. This was a thought-provoking late entry to the list, and for Investigation Discovery, which did seem to be trying to pivot throughout the year with varying degrees of success to a less by-numbers-ly trashy slate of programming, this was a strong note for the network to go out on. And as I said, it's on Investigation Discovery. Our next item is number five, Disgraced. That one's on Showtime. They put out some really good documentaries on that network, and they tend to get overlooked because it's not HBO. I myself forgot that this one was not a 30 for 30. The story is that in 2003, college hoop star Patrick Dennehy was murdered by a teammate, and the subsequent accusations against his school, Baylor University, and his head coach, Dave Bliss, got real ugly. This is a skillfully constructed and infuriating movie, and although I'm not sure how you'll put hands to it if you don't subscribe to Showtime, it is on Hulu if you subscribe to the network there. The network. I don't know what I'm talking about sometimes. As I'm sure you have noticed, I grouped items four and three together. That was LA 92 and Burn Motherfucker Burn. They are on the same topic and I watched them at the same time. Burn is from Showtime. See my previous comments. LA 92 is from National Geographic, and you can dig that joint on the National Geographic website. Like I said, I'm taking these two together because that's how I watch them, and that's how John Ramos and I discussed them in an earlier episode. One of the best parts for me of the 30 for 30 seven-part documentary on O.J. Simpson was the film pulling the thread of the riots and seeing how some of what we think or thought about the O.J. case was going to unravel. And these films keep pulling farther back on that thread of the riots and L.A.'s racial tensions and scars. I think O.J. only had five parts. And that symbology of the thread totally doesn't work. Here's the point. I was in college in the East when the riots went down. It all seemed very remote to me. After watching these films, I had a far better sense of Los Angeles in its entirety, its preoccupations, its decades-old scars, and how long the explosion in 92 had been coming. Excellent but sobering work on both. And as I said, LA 92 is from Nat Geo. Burn Motherfucker Burn is from Showtime. And I actually don't think watching them back to back is a terrible idea. They are not made the same way or with exactly the same focus, but taking them together really makes you look at the entirety of the event and just kind of sit with it and think some new things. The number two item is called Tower. Here's a quote from my review from February. Tower is the distinctively told story of the University of Texas Tower shooting, adapted from a Texas Monthly anniversary piece on the murders using voiceover reenactments of the oral history, contemporary footage of the campus, and animation. End quote. This shouldn't have worked, but the director, Keith Maitland, is smart to work off Pamela Koloff's excellent piece on Charles Whitman's shooting rampage at the end of the 60s. I would also add that going to Texas Monthly's archives and looking up Koloff's other work is time well spent. This animation could have been twee, but instead it's devastating, as are the soundtrack choices and very unaffected talking head interviews with the witnesses. This aired on Independent Lens, which is a PBS joint, and I'm not seeing it on the website, but if you have the PBS app, try there or check your on-demand listings. And my top entry for movies in the true crime genre that I saw on TV, and this was the most mentioned by you, the listeners, when I solicited your suggestions for the best of the year, was Mommy, Dead, and Dearest. Aaron Lee Carr is such a good director at such a young age that it makes me kind of mad. Mostly it makes me want to give her money to work on more stuff faster so that I can see more of her work. I'm sure that you've heard of this film, but just in case, Gypsy Rose Blanchard killed her mother, Dee Dee. And the more you hear about the late Dee Dee's grifthousing by proxy scams at her daughter's expense, the more you sympathize with the girl. When you're not wondering whether or not Gypsy Lee took the wrong lessons from her mother's dead-eyed example. Aaron Lee Carr also directed the Cannibal Cop doc for HBO, and I recommend that one as well. She has a really good ear for film narrative, and she's not trying to, like, story up the story in the style of Errol Morris. That's fine. I love Errol Morris, but if you're not Errol Morris, it's probably better to leave it out, in my opinion. Carr does not do a lot of news magazine underlining either. It's a confident and pro entry and smart enough to stay out of the way of what is a ripping yarn in almost anyone's hands. This was the best of the year for me in the movie category. And it is also from HBO. So now we're going to move along to the TV series. Some of these maybe should be considered just really long movies, but let's just go with it. Honorable mentions from you guys for Chandra Levy in American Murder Mystery, which I believe is Investigation Discovery, and The Murder of Lacey Peterson, and Law & Order True Crime, The Menendez Murders. Law & Order True Crime did not make the cut for me. I didn't hate it, but you can go back in our archives and listen to me and my esteemed colleague and work wife, Tara Ariano, talking about each episode on The Blotter Presents Summary Judgment. That's in our archives, previously.tv/podcasts. I liked some things about it. Other things I didn't have much use for. It was a little too long. I'm looking forward to seeing what Dick Wolf does next with this franchise. But those did not make my list. I am kind of liking the American Murder Mystery franchise. Some of them are pretty interesting. Some of them are, you know, pro forma and just not even rising to the level of Hotel TV. But there's some new ones coming up in the new year, and I'm looking forward to seeing what cases they choose to cover. Let's get to my list. Of the top 10 TV series in the true crime genre for 2017, number 10, to my surprise, Guilty Rich. This dropped in the fall of this year, and I hadn't watched it until I was hunting around for a cold case segment for a recent episode that I recorded with Stephanie Kangro. Guilty Rich is not great, but for what it is, it's quite well done. For viewers already familiar with the cases on offer, I wouldn't necessarily say this is a great sit, but they get better graphics than most shows of its ilk, and the narrator is plummy and committed, and I could not figure out from Googling who it is, although some site mentioned that it's Susan Sarandon. Is this true? Please at me somewhere in our social media, which is at Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. If that's actually Susan Sarandon, I kind of don't even know what to say about that, except... All right, Louise. Okay, so yeah, I think there were 6 or 7 episodes. They're all on the Investigation Discovery website. And again, it's not, you know, it's not making a murderer, but for what it is, it knows what it is and it does what it is really well. And I think at this particular juncture of American history, hating on the murderous wealthy is something that we can all enjoy. Number 9 is Gone, The Forgotten Women of Ohio. This is a compelling case, but the series is frustrating because I'm not sure the case is as compelling as now 2 series posit that it is. Let me try to explain. I couldn't agree more, let me just say, with the premise of both this series and Investigation Discoveries that preceded it on the same topic, which I believe was called Vanished, The Missing Women of Chillicothe. which is that sex workers who are, often ones struggling with addiction, going missing and turning up dead, should not be something that, these are not victims that should be dismissed as less than deserving of a full court investigation, because they aren't. With that said, sometimes a cigar, et cetera. I mean, again, this is not to say that these women deserved what happened to them. They didn't. They were living high risk lives. That's not a value judgment from me and shouldn't be from anyone else, particularly law enforcement. But there does seem to be the instinct with this series of disappearances to try to gin up a like larger and more formalized conspiracy around the murders, and it's just not necessary. This is one from Joe Berlinger of the Paradise Lost series. He is excellent at building narrative, but his co-investigator on this one can come off as self-published at times, and I respect their efforts to get justice for everyone, but drug dealers kill people and get away with it sometimes, and it's not that we shouldn't care. It's that I don't know if that sad fact, A, has as much to do with a homicidal mastermind as it does with the, like, general blast radius of the opioid epidemic generally. And this is, after all, Ohio, one of the harder hit states, if I'm not mistaken. I also don't know if B, this investigation warranted 8 episodes. With that said, Berlinger is a pro and it's an okay sit. I'm just not sure you need to give it your full attention every second. Ditto our number 8 entry, Live PD. This is on, you're constantly on A&E somehow, and it's good in between TV. It's the sort of thing you might watch if, say, a college basketball game ended, but the next airing of Despicable Me has not begun. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we got some twisted viewing habits in this house. That aside, that's not a crime that they've made into a series yet. Ray Live PD, Dan Abrams's two-camera gawping can wear on you after a while, but if you like cops, you'll like this. And occasionally you do get a real nail biter. I think you can stream this, although it's not necessarily worthwhile to view it that way if it's no longer live, but it is on A&E's website. And now that I'm talking, I'm not 100% convinced that that premiered this year, but I think it did. And if it didn't, at me. I'm around. Number 7 on the list of series is the Confession Tapes. And I had nearly forgotten we covered this on the podcast, but it's worth recollecting and looking into, although I can't necessarily recommend binging it because it's kind of bleak. Not in Ray the crimes themselves, but the quote unquote justice on offer and how easy it is to get a false confession and to see that that's what's happening, at least for those of us who consume a lot of these stories. The idea that people, particularly those with intellectual differences, will literally say anything if they're promised a ride home from the station has been out there since the aforementioned Paradise Lost films and certainly was front of mind for audiences after Making a Murderer. This puts yet another button on it and a depressing one. This is one of the overlooked entries of the year, I think, by other critics, and you can find that one on Netflix. Number 6 is Village of the Damned, another one we spoke about pretty recently on the podcast. The citizens of Dryden, New York, the village in question, are apparently not happy with the series and how it's portrayed. I can't really speak to those concerns, although the last episode I watched did seem to exploit somewhat the primary subject who was discussing her husband's or ex-husband's. It's not clear. More on that in a second. She was discussing her ex-husband's, I guess, mental illness in a perhaps folksier than appropriate tone. And then her grown sons, who are also being interviewed, were in the next room and are really just now learning how sick their father was from overhearing their mom's talking head interview. It's affecting, but it's also kind of rough. And then we're told that the guy was paroled, the husband or ex-husband was paroled in July of this year. But that's all we're told. Not if he has a relationship with his family, what's become of him, if he got treatment in prison. The pacing of this show can be odd. It's well constructed and ish. And those episode enders are expertly done so as not to feel too cynically gotcha. But it also can feel sometimes like the production identified the done to go out on and worked backwards from there and skipped over some information sometimes and padded with B-roll of grave sites at other times. And I resist Googling the cases that they're covering, but I think if you do look them up, it probably does let the air out of watching the show. That said, better proportions of content to filler than you'd expect, despite the kind of grindhouse title. This one is also on Investigation Discovery, and by the time you hear this, it will have aired its finale. You can find that on demand and on the Investigation Discovery site. Number five is Mindhunter. This is based loosely on Godfather of the FBI profiling program, John Douglas's book. Not nearly as flattering to him as his books tend to be. Mindhunter had its issues, among them bringing Anator's character into the narrative too late. The casting of Jonathan Groff, he was good, but he wouldn't have been my first or even 50th choice. And of course, that girlfriend and the show's insistence that the job ruined Holden for normal relationships when all available on-screen evidence suggested that Debbie was a superior snot who enjoyed feeling like she could do better and took the first opportunity to do so. The Dennis Rader bits landed as artsy affectations that didn't drive the story, but Groff and Holt McElhaney's co-worker chemistry is fantastic. McElhaney is perfectly cast here, finally, and Cameron Britton as Ed Kemper is excellent. Riveting. This one is on Netflix, and if you're partway through an early episode and capital J just can't with Debbie, just fast forward her. You really won't miss anything. This one was also mentioned by listeners as a favorite of the year. Also mentioned by numerous listeners, one I didn't cover on the podcast, American Vandal. I meant to save this one for a holiday binge, but past guest, current husband Dan Patrick Brady and I decided to, quote, try one recently and ended up powering through the entire series in one night. This one's fictional, of course, so I sort of had been avoiding it for the podcast, but it's masterful satirizing of true crime programming tropes, which derive, it's very clear, from a deep love of the genre. I mean, it has to go on the list, not to mention how many times the word dicks is uttered and also the phrase ball hairs. I mean, it's perfect for both someone steeped in true crime as a genre and someone who is emotionally 5 years old, like your host. The last couple of episodes of American Vandal do start to take themselves a little too seriously, and some of the B-roll cliches are well observed, but likely wouldn't be possible or credible for high school sophomores, like some of the crane and chopper shots. You're like, what? But it's a delight nonetheless, and I am interested to see what they do with it in a second season. That one is also streamable on Netflix. Also on Netflix, although it originally aired on Spike, is my number three series, Time, the Kalief Browder Story. Maybe it's because this aired so early in the year. Maybe it's because it's such a New York story. I don't know, but I do know that not a lot of people are talking about this one in their best of lists for the year. It's a heartbreaking collage about the notorious arrest, confinement, and subsequent depression and demise of Kalief Browder after he allegedly nicked a backpack. I do think it should have been in the discussion of the year's top properties. It's textured, it's affecting, it's maddening. It's not straining for significance. It's not pulling any punches about the racial and economic divides that played a role in this tragedy. It's a short series, but it's worth catching up on. And again, you can find it on Netflix, and it may also be on demand. You can check your listings. The second best on my list of TV series, which was probably really a movie, but to even out the list, I put it here, and it's so good, is Cold-Blooded. This is Joe Berlinger's look at the Clutter murders made so famous by In Cold Blood by Truman Capote, and at the town and families that had to decorate around the holes left by their deaths. It's just beautiful. This is the best and most compelling kind of refocusing onto the victims of a crime, the kind that isn't sort of cheapened with fillery shots of someone's kind of good friend walking over a bridge and staring wet-eyed into the middle distance. This is very real, gives you a genuine sense of these people, this family, versus the like non-significant, she loved to laugh sort of thing that you usually hear. It's scary. It's gorgeous. It's respectfully curious. My guest host, Mark Blankenship, for that episode, and I loved this one. And if, like me, you doff your hat to Truman Capote's contributions to the genre while sometimes thinking he was too much of the story in Cold Blood and should be subtracted from it a little bit, you will like this one too. And you'll find that on the Sundance website, and it was mentioned by you listeners. Mentioned also by the listeners, and my number one series in the true crime genre for 2017 is The Keepers. I really can't recommend that you binge watch this with family, at least not family under 18, but it's absolutely gripping. It sort of starts out as this decades-old mystery surrounding the murder of a beloved nun and teacher at a Catholic school, and it just begins to zig and zag into hideous revelations about systemic abuse of girl students at the school where Sister Kathy taught, culminating in a showdown with the Archdiocese of Baltimore. All of the witnesses are incredibly courageous, but Jean Hargadon Wainer's testimony is especially so, not just because it's unflinching, but because actually a lot of the time it is flinching. She's still pained and furious by what happened to her, and the way that this series is constructed brings you into the story with these people and makes you feel like you know them, which is really quite a feat. It's not a perfect piece of storytelling, but it isn't ever dull. And it's shocking, and that it's still shocking is a good thing. It's what makes it art, and it's what makes it important, and it's what reminds us that part of why we watch true crime and are preoccupied with crimes and murders and these cases is not like a necessarily a gossipy instinct, although I think that's part of it, at least for me, I have to say. But that I think we're always looking for that core or that thread of humanity in the stories, and the fact that there is still the capacity to be shocked when, you know, it is my job to watch so much of this stuff is something positive. I would like to hope on the eve of a new year, looking at the scads of true crime programming that we have to look forward to in 2018. I'm trying to take something good and, I don't know, probative from this. Anyway, The Keepers is on Netflix and is my top pick for the year. And again, it was mentioned by you guys. Thank you guys so much for listening to The Blotter all year and for your suggestions. They're always welcome. If you head to previously.tv/forums and you find the Blotter section, there is a forum thread called the TPB tip line. That's where I want to hear your suggestions for future episodes. That is true now more than ever. We have some choices to make, you and I, coming up as to what we cover in January, and I'd love to hear from you also on our website. On our Facebook page at facebook.com/blotterpresents, and of course on Twitter at blotterpresents. Very happy new year to all of you, and I look forward to hearing your thoughts in 2018.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv podcast network.